Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Give Carol Mittire a scalpel, an exam room, and a fresh-killed creature, and this wildlife pathologist is almost certain to tell you how it died. Doesn't matter if it's a walrus or a turkey vulture, a snapping turtle, or a swan. She's opened up wolf and beaver, elk and cormorant, looking for why they perished. Her studies vividly tell the story of our natural world. This hour on Point, it's CSI Animal Kingdom, straight from the exam table. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine the stories these animals tell about their lives and ours, our shared environment? It's life and death dramas. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will learn about a newly discovered mountain stronghold of thriving snow leopards in war-torn Afghanistan. But first, the sound of the wildlife pathologist at work. Carol Mittire joins us in a moment, but here's a little tape from her dictaphone as she, in her lab in Madison, Wisconsin, performs a necropsy, not an autopsy because it's an animal, on a wild goose at the National Wildlife Health Center. Here she is at work.
April 18, 2011, date examined April 20, 2011, pathologist attire, species Canada goose, specimen carcass. The goose was not euthanized, and the weight is 5650 grams. External exam, the carcass is water soaked. The eyes are autolyzed and perforated due to autolysis. The conjunctiva are pale. The feather slough was gentle rubbing. The oral mucosa is unremarkable. The keel is only mildly palpable. There is abundant pectoral muscling. There is no evidence of fractures on palpation of the legs and wings. And the feet and foot webs are unremarkable.
And you are in another world, the world of the wildlife pathologist. Joining me now from Carol Mittire, from Madison, Wisconsin, is Carol Mittire, wildlife pathologist and veterinarian at the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison. Every day, animal remains are shipped in there by FedEx and UPS in coolers from around the country for her examination and explanation. She's examined over 6,000 animals in her 27-year-long career as wildlife pathologist. Carol Mittire, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me. I'm excited to be on your program.
Give us a sense of the range of creatures who have been on your exam table, Carol.
Oh, if you look at the broad spectrum of animals, I've looked at mammals, wolves, sea otters, coyotes, fox. I've looked at birds, swans, whooping cranes, storm petrels, catbirds, birds from your backyard, or birds that are pelagic and only on the ocean, never touch land.
I've got a list here of it gets up towards 6,000. I mean, every kind of duck you can imagine, mallard, mottled, pintail, northern ruddy, teal, wood, eagles, bald and golden, peregrine falcons, and red fox, you name it, right on down, as you say, great horned owl. And, you know, is there anything that doesn't come to your table? What are the limits? What are the boundaries of the animal kingdom that you examine upon death?
Vertebrates. Mostly we examine vertebrates. So even reptiles and amphibians. I've been on a project with corals.
Not bugs, I guess.
No, not bugs, not insects, or although we study the insects on the carcasses or the parasites and nematodes in the carcass, I don't personally do any dissection of those.
I see a jaguar in here. I see trumpeter swan and mute swan and tundra swan and a screech owl and turkey vulture, right on down, beaver, blackbird, bluebird, brown booby, American coot, double-crested cormorant. Who sends you all these creatures, Carol, and in what circumstances?
The circumstances are that biologists or even individuals, you know, just the public goes for a walk outside, backyard, in a public park, and they see dead animals. Those dead animals are reported to the biologists in the area. We primarily work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but in the past 10 years, we've been working more and more with state biologists and some university specialists. So we help whenever there's a need and our expertise can help solve a problem.
What does that mean? I mean, animals die all the time, as humans and everything else does. Death comes with life. You know, what presents itself as the need to understand why this or that particular creature has died?
I think part of that interest is that we never know what that dead animal represents. Did the animal die from just an individual traumatic event, flying into a window, miscalculating a landing, or does that bird represent the beginning of an epidemic, the beginning of an introduction of a new disease potentially? We actually most often get animals sent into us that are part of a very large die-off event. So maybe even as much as 20,000 animals dead on a lake, in a pond, a river, on the ocean being washed ashore.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be sent a subset of those animals because once you get even to just 10 or 20, there's definitely something in the environment that is putting the wildlife at risk.
So it may be the animals are sent to you because people are worried about something going on in the environment that's created a dangerous change. What about sent to you because people are interested in whether or not there's a crime that's been committed in the death of this animal?
That occurs as well. There are situations where individuals feel it is their prerogative to protect their property. Maybe they have backyard chickens and they don't want hawks or eagles, you know, taking them for food. Situations where they will then put bait out, and in those conditions, the law enforcement branch of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or if it's a state investigation, they will prosecute based on what we find at the necropsy table and what our tests show as far as how that animal died and what compounds might have been involved.
At the necropsy table, it may be something on the order of the murder of an animal. It may be something bigger going on. Carol Mattire jumps into all of those on her examination table there in Madison, Wisconsin. And there have been plenty in recent years. Here's a little sound, Carol. You'll remember this. White-nose bat disease was first found in New York State in 2007. Since then, the disease has killed millions of bats. It's spreading west and north into Canada. Here's a 2009 CBS News report on the syndrome.
Researchers are trying to solve one of the most devastating mysteries in the natural world, the huge and rapid die-off of the species named little brown bats.
It's unprecedented in North American wildlife, at least in recorded history.
Biologists are struggling to understand a fungus called white nose syndrome. It's killed more than a million bats over just three winters.
And a lot of the explanation for why they died unfolded on the examination table of Carol Mattire, who's with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Carol, I'm looking down. Suddenly, just a couple of years ago, lots of bats start coming in to you there at the National Wildlife Health Center. This is part of the USGS. And I'm looking on the list here, big brown bat, Brazilian free-tailed bat, eastern pipistrelle bat, gray bat, little brown, northern long-eared, silver-haired, right on down. What happened? How did you know when something was going on with bats here, Carol?
We have an excellent liaison with biologists in the field, and when they notice something unusual, they will call us and they'll ask us to help. In this particular situation, biologists in New York noticed it at the end of hibernation in the caves. in around Albany, New York, there were dead bats on the floor of the caves, and they were alarmed. They predicted it would happen again in 2008, and when it did, they called our lab to assist in trying to determine what was killing the bats. The initial event, finding a number of dead bats on the floor of a hibernacula, a cave where bats hibernate, was unprecedented in recent history. And so we were called in to try to help with that investigation and determine the cause of death.
So when you get onto a project like that, what does that mean? You've got coolers coming in every day from around the country, in this case from the Northeast, with recently dead bats in them that you then line up for necropsy, for what we think of in humans as autopsy?
That's correct. They are shipped overnight. They're very fresh when they arrive. And in fact, the necropsy tables that we use are autopsy tables from, the medical field. And they work very well for us. So a lot of what we do is much in parallel with what the forensic pathologists and the pathologists do in the medical field.
So we heard you on the dictaphone there earlier with the Canada goose on the table. That sounded very familiar from what we've seen on television in the fictional portrayals, the dramatic portrayals on CSI. It's sort of step-by-step observing and taking apart, I guess, the remains of this creature to figure out what's happened here.
Yeah, that's true. One potential difference, although if you relate it to CSI, I guess there are mysteries there as well, but none of our animals come in with their own story as far as what proceeded prior to death.
Mm-hmm. So there's no police report exactly surrounding them, often just the body.
Right. We have the evidence that might be there. We have the biologists that tell us what's there, but no one has watched that animal die. So we have to start piecing together that story when it arrives.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a kind of CSI for the animal kingdom with wildlife pathologist Carol Mattire of the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin. Bats, wolves, eagles, frogs, and the stories that their autopsies or necropsies tell. She's there right now. Here's the sound of her. We heard her earlier with a Canada goose. Here's the sound of Carol Mattire on her dictaphone with a wolf laid out on the table. It's come in like everything else overnight in a cooler from some far-off location. She's in the process of taking it apart to figure out why it died.
There is abundant fluid ballotment in the abdomen, and the carcass is soiled. Serous anguinous fluid is present on the muzzle. The left upper canine tooth is broken. The incisors are mildly worn, and the other teeth are unremarkable.
And another mystery begins to unfold on her autopsy table there. There are many. Sometimes it's a single wolf. Sometimes it's a lot of deaths. And quickly, here's sound from this past New Year's Eve, or just after, when thousands of blackbirds fell from the sky in Beebe, Arkansas. One local resident described the situation to the news station there.
Then I just immediately called mom because I had to go to work, and I said, you've got to come get the kids and get the dog because I don't know what's going on, but I don't want to mess in with any of them. It was horrible. You could not even get down the road without running over hundreds. It was that bad.
Carol Mattire looks for explanations. She joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. And Carol, a lot of callers for you. David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, you're on the air with Carol Mattire.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I guess this past year, there were a couple of incidences that I heard about, somewhere of a population of about 5,000 to 8,000 birds just kind of dropping out of the sky and, just death. And in all my 44 years, I've never heard of that ever happening. And I just wanted to know what kinds of things caused that. And if she happened to work or, perform any of the pathologist-type procedures on those birds that, when that happened.
David, let us pick it up. And Carol, I mean, these things happen. It wasn't that long ago. There were 40,000 ducks went down from a plague in South Dakota. David's asking about the blackbirds in Arkansas that we all heard about after New Year's Eve there. I think those did come into your lab. What happened then? What did you find, Carol?
They did come into our lab, and one of the other pathologists, we have three pathologists right now, did the necropsies on those and found that they died of trauma. Again, an isolated incident like that is very unusual for us as well.
Trauma meaning sort of blunt force impact?
Yes, there is evidence of hemorrhage on the brain. There's hemorrhage in the chest. Sometimes the heart is ruptured. So it's as though the bird with a relatively high rate of speed ran into something dead on. And, you know, birds are survivalists and they would not do that without a reason. And so then we really do need to partner very aggressively with our biologist collaborators in the field and get the information they've been pulling together and what we're seeing on the table, make sure that it wasn't an infectious disease or some sort of a plume of toxic smoke. Mm-hmm. All of those things, step by step, are being eliminated as possibilities.
So you come back to them, you say it's trauma, it's blunt force. As I recall that incident, they went out and found that there were a lot of fireworks put off that night. The birds kind of panicked in the middle of the night and flew out from their roosting place and just ran into everything in sight, and many of them went down. Let's turn to another example with the bats. I wish you'd kind of walk us through what came in and how you went about surgically dissecting the bat and examining tissue to figure out what was going on with this this problem that's hitting bats all over the Northeast and beyond now?
Would you want me to set the stage a little bit and
bring
you down in the necropsy suite with me?
Yes, please.
Okay. We have a facility in Madison, Wisconsin, National Wildlife Health Center, and the basement contains our necropsy suite. There are a lot of precautions in that facility to prevent any type of infectious agent getting out. So we walk into the locker room and we take off our street clothes, mm-hmm. and we put on a smock and go through a door into a clean corridor. And there is a vacuum then, mm-hmm. as we walk into the actual changing room, which is part of the necropsy suite. There's a vapor lock. You open the door and you hear the whoosh of air because all of the air is going into the necropsy area and mm-hmm. none escapes.
Okay.
And so then we change into our scrubs and our boots and put on our masks, and we walk into the actual necropsy room, get down to business, put on a disposable surgical smock, and we have a great staff that helps us at the table.
Mm-hmm.
They bring the history and in this case, a bat to the table, and I begin my dictation, as you heard earlier, where I dictate the history, where it's from, when it died, you know, what have they seen in the field that will give us some clues.
So put the bat on the table for us and begin, get your scalpel out and begin to unfold, if that's the right word. I'm sure
yeah.
it's not, but this bat, how you go about sort of getting into the remains to figure out what happened.
I first do an external exam, and all pathologists probably have a preference, but I always have the head to my left. It orients me. I look at the eyes. I want to see if there's anything going on that might suggest a fever, septicemia. Are the eyelids congested? I check the ears. Open the mouth. We look at the teeth. We look at the lining of the mouth, the mucosa. Everything can give some clues as to how the animal is feeling before it died. And with white nose syndrome, it is one of the most fascinating characteristics of that disease is that the fungus is so delicate. Once the biologists bring it out of the cave, the delicate hyphae just disappear. The fungi disappear. When we get it into the lab, we don't see it.
They say white nose syndrome. So what, that when they find the bat, they can see something going on around the nose? Is that still evident by the time it's shipped overnight to you?
If they see what looks like bread mold on the face of the bat, mm-hmm. and there's a little bit on the wings, but as soon as they carry that bat outside of the cave, that mold or fungus is so delicate that it disappears. And they have even sent us bats that have such an intense infection, and they've apologized because when they packaged it, they couldn't see the fungus anymore. So we have to shift into, they said it was here. Let's take some samples. Let's send some to our, send some of that muzzle to our microbiologist. They'll put it on media. They'll try to grow the fungus while I'm downstairs taking samples, mm-hmm. putting it in a jar of formalin, mm-hmm. preserving it so that I can look at it under a microscope on glass slides. Mm. And we're primarily just with small animals, just a forceps and a scalpel and scissors, and same thing they'd use in a biology high school classroom.
Right.
And so my scalpel will start to open the skin, trying not to puncture anything underneath the skin, and I reflect or fold back the skin from pretty much stem to stern.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to see, is there's evidence of bruising? Are the lymph nodes okay? So all of the different tissues that are under the skin, we will then examine.
Carol, hold the thought right there. We've got a question on the bats in particular. It could be a bat, could be a bluebird. In her time, it could have been a walrus, and has been. Howard in Plattsburgh, New York. Howard, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. A question about white nose syndrome. The fungus, I understand, is a Geomycetes species. And a couple of questions. Is it a newly recognized species? And is that fungus established, has it been established that that is the primary cause, or is the fungus possibly a secondary cause to someone's Lyme condition? That's my question.
Howard, we've got a knowledgeable listener here who wants to know more about what you found on the examination table. What about the species of fungus that, with the white-nosed bat situation?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And it was a question that everyone involved in the investigation was trying to tease apart in 2008 and 2009. And our center, David Bleher particularly, he's our microbiologist, he did take that fungus that was consistently found on bats infected with white nose, and he speciated it. He, with his colleagues that are, you know, expert research microbiologists, determined that it was a brand new species. Never before defined in the United States, never named anywhere else. The genetics of it, the the DNA was different from anything that had ever been seen before. And so that was a breakthrough, because finally we had at least a cause. We had what we call an etiology that might be putting these bats at risk. Is it the only? The other question, though, was, is it the only? Is it the sole cause of white nose syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
We have to go with our best scientific evidence. As soon as we get involved in an investigation that has no precedent set before, you move with the best evidence you've got. And infection trials have been in the works. It looks like this fungus will cause enough damage to the very delicate wing membrane of the bats and the muzzle, the tissues of the face, that it has the potential to be the sole cause of mortality.
I want to think more about how this fungus and other threats like that come into our environment. But we've got people thinking about you in your environment there at the examination table, Carol, in Madison. John in Nashville, you're on the air, John. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Carol touched on the precautions she takes, but is she ever concerned or worried that she might be in harm with some of these, given that she works with a lot of unknown causes?
Good question. And you've worked with West Nile virus, Carol. What about your safety? You're going into a vapor lock examination suite, necropsy suite, as you call it. What about your safety there?
We do take that into consideration for anybody that works down in that area. We even have health screening every year. When an animal comes and is placed on the table, we have to assume that it could be anything. We can have beavers with tularemia. We can have birds with West Nile virus. We're gloved. We wear masks. We practice very, very good biosecurity, containment. Everything is washed, scrubbed down, and because we are a biosafety level 3 facility, it means that we can handle the most worrisome infectious agents. We even have a shower. As we leave, we can take a shower, take off everything we've had in that infected site, in that that changing area, take a shower. So we're concerned, but we pretty much we work with this day to day. So we take our precautions, and if we open the animal and we see something that looks like might put humans at risk at well, not only do we amp up our caution, but we also tell the people in the field that you brought this animal in, beware. If there are people in the environment, there aren't a lot of infections that would cause harm to, to humans, exactly. But we're seeing more and more of them as we push our way into the wild animal ecosystems. We're seeing more of these diseases that can affect humans, that can affect our agricultural animals, domestic animals. So it's a precaution definitely that we keep in mind.
Pam's calling from Monticello, Kentucky. Pam, thanks very much for calling. How do you pronounce your town's name? I never know which way to go with that one, Pam.
It is Monticello here.
Very good. Okay, Monticello. What's your question for Carol, Pam?
Thank you for taking my call. About a year ago, there was a report that thousands, if not millions, of songbirds were circling cell phone towers and becoming exhausted and dropping dead. Have you run into that, Carol?
Songbirds circling cell phone towers. Carol?
I did have an interesting case last fall, and it was a situation. There are certain types of birds that are very intense flockers. And so if they fly at night, if they're migrating, particularly towers that have red lights tend to attract the birds, and yet they don't want to get too close. And they start circling at a certain perimeter. They continue circling. Like you said, they start flocking as a group. And the birds I looked at particularly were Lapland longspurs. And I went back to the literature. I Googled it. I said, why did these birds die at a perimeter of, 50 yards from this one? It wasn't a cell tower. It was a petroleum processing tower, like a derrick.
Yep.
And I got into the literature, and I saw Lapland longspurs as long ago as 1930 had been documented in similar situations in streetlights, in farm communities in Iowa. And so, again, I was worried, was there a plume of some toxic element? Was there something, radiation causing this death? But in actuality, we could go back historically and see that there are just some species that will start circling and they will not stop.
That would be at the small end of vertebrates that you deal with. What about the large end? You mentioned walrus. What are the biggest animals that you've worked with on the necropsy table?
Yeah, a walrus won't fit on a necropsy table. And that was when I worked for the County of Los Angeles. I was one of their pathologists, and we worked with Marineland. And they did lose one of their walruses, which can weigh as much as 2 tons. It's a whole different dynamic. You need ladders, and it's a full-day process. But interestingly, all the organs are the same. They're just different dimensions. They're but they're still a heart's a heart. And this poor animal had twins. It was a female, and her uterine had twisted and torsed. And, with an animal that size, how would you know that there was something going on? And animals can't tell us. We look for clinical signs. What is going on that we can see? But they can't tell us symptoms. They can't tell us my abdomen hurts. They can't tell us that I'm hot. They can't tell us I'm nauseated. So we have to look at them and try to, as best we can, even when they're alive, be almost their eyes and ears and try to interpret what they're telling us.
You did have, I think, right onto your table a gray wolf, quite large, from Alaska, shipped in.
Yes, we did. We still do quite a few wolves. Many of the gray wolves are no longer endangered in their individual areas, but we do red wolves and we do Mexican wolves. And because they're along the border of Mexico, and they do, they were native to the United States. And a lot of times we will take x-rays first because they are prime targets for being shot. So we need to help the forensic, do our forensic mode then and try to investigate, was this animal shot or was there something else going on?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the kind of CSI for the animal kingdom with wildlife pathologist Carol Mattire of the National Wildlife Center in Madison, Wisconsin. She is sent by state and federal biologists all kinds of dead animals with stories to be told, and she figures them out on her necropsy table, her examination table there. In just a few minutes, we're going to hear about a new discovery of a stronghold of snow leopards found in, of all places, Afghanistan. But right now, we're with Carol Mattire. Casey's calling from Spokane, Washington. Casey, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you today?
Pretty well.
Well, I have a question for about the more educational part of it. I've been a student. I was a nursing major. I was a tutor for anatomy lab, dissected like 27 people, and I worked for Skeleton Limited International, articulating skeletons for museums. I have a passion for biological anthropology and stuff, but with the economy the way it is, it's unlikely I'm going to go back to school and spend $300,000 to maybe not even get a job. Is there any kind of internship programs, any, you know, back in the old days you used to be able to work your reputation and
right, sort of path or career path into this kind of work, this wildlife pathology, Casey?
Yeah.
Yeah. Carol, what do you say to Casey?
I think there are different levels that you can help wildlife. We are, I would say, pretty specialized at the National Wildlife Health Center. So we do, you know, our technicians and we
You're
have
a veterinarian,
biologists.
I guess.
I'm a veterinarian, yeah. For my particular specialty, you know, I went to 4 years of college, four years of veterinary school, 1 year of internship, and 3 years of residency. So, you know.
That's a lot.
It was exciting all the way through, but it's a lot. But on the ground, there are, you know, out in the field, there are a lot of opportunities. When we talk about the economy and how to put food on the table, some of it is following your passion and talking to as many people as you possibly can that are in line with that passion and just hoping opportunities will show themselves while you're, you know, providing your family with what they need.
Right. Maybe something in the field you're suggesting where the work is done that brings you these specimens in the first place.
Yeah, we at our lab, we have microbiologists, parasitologists, virologists, but in the field, our primary partners that are so critical to us, you know, they're biologists, you know, even the people that work in the parks, and they are always on the lookout, and they help with studies. And so kind of a biology background and then going to the parks and seeing if there are available positions.
A role there.
Exactly, yeah.
Casey, that might be a way. Let me go to another here. Beth in Lexington, Massachusetts. Beth, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm calling about just big themes. We always hear about global warming and what people's contribution is to that, and I wondered if your guest has any specific advice or has noticed any particular big themes that might be man-made that we could all do something about.
Yeah, Beth, I've been heading there myself, and I'm glad you asked it. I mean, Carol, you've been doing this for 27 years now. You've seen so many creatures that have died. Do you see, when you look out to Beth's question, a kind of steady state evidence coming from nature or rising tide of problems? Do you see environmental issues laid out on your table every day?
I think that what we see on the table gives us a fairly good clue of what's going on in the environment. One of like big picture, I guess the biggest picture is habitat loss. You know, the human population is growing. We're taking a bigger footprint on the environment, and our footprint then takes away from the habitat and the ecology that these animals need, particularly what comes to my mind first are migratory birds, waterfowl. They need to winter in the United States in areas. They come from Russia, they come from Alaska, and they come to the United States to overwinter where it's warmer in our southern area. And they've come there for thousands of years. And as the population encroaches on their wetlands, these populations of thousands and thousands of birds, many different species, are concentrated. And really, that is sort of a perfect storm for passing infectious disease. Not only do they potentially not have enough food and resources, they get stressed because they're so close together in a limited space. And then if one does break with an infection, just like in people, it's going to spread more rapidly.
And how does that show up in your examination room?
The role we play is, again, sort of a second tier. We have the biologists in the field that see the maybe 10,000 birds dead. They send them to us. And I guess the way we look at it and the way we can see the perspective is our lab started in the 1970s, and we have over a 30-year database. So we can kind of see the shift of where the infectious diseases might be more prominent, what might be happening in the environment. We do we collaborate with modelers. We have modelers that take this data and try to make some ecologic big picture sense out of what we see day to day. I may look at one bird at a time, and they can take those trends. We've looked at 65,000 birds, one bird at a time, but there's a huge picture that can be painted.
If you never set foot out of your suite of examination facilities there, you know, what would what you're seeing on the table tell you about the health of the planet outside, Carol?
I guess, you know, if you want, I always go back to specifics, but we do get contaminants cases. We get cases where there are still pockets of organochlorine. Chemical pollution.
Is it worse than it was 27 years ago? I mean, if you were not looking outside your window, is it steady state, or do you think, oh my God, you know, it's a meltdown out there?
I think that the United States has a great reputation for stewardship of wildlife. And they've passed laws of, you know, even through the world wars, there were laws being passed to increase habitat preservation, to set aside national parks. I think that if that can continue, if that ethic of stewardship for our wildlife and our wild lands can continue, it will serve us well, because really the pollution factor has decreased. I think we look at wildlife a little bit now, maybe as sentinels. You know, what are the emerging diseases? Almost all the emerging diseases in humans have now started in wildlife. You know, most of these in Asia. But we still have some of those scenarios to be concerned about. So wildlife can look, you know, can present themselves as sentinels. They tell us what is in the environment, and is it a risk to us or not? And our center is really well placed with all of our historic perspective to say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, it's awful to hear that 10,000 birds die, but it happens in the winter. It happens in that wetlands every year, and it's nothing for, you know, the public to be personally concerned about, but we do need to be concerned, you know, for the population that's in that particular location.
As I listen to you, I'm awfully glad you're there doing this work day in and day out. I might choose it, but you not choose it as my life's work, but your passion for it is so clear. There's all the talk about budgets now and cutbacks. Is your work secure, or are you on the chopping block?
I guess I'd just like to say that there are many different reasons why wildlife are critical. Economically, they bring in millions and millions of dollars every year, not just hunting, but right below hunting, which is probably the main economic stimulus that wildlife brings, is even just the non-consumptive bird watching or wildlife watching. It is an incredible economic boon to the United States. The other way is by what we call ecological services. the ecological service of a bat eating, you know, hundreds of thousands of insects that might be destroying cropland. And then they also have intrinsic value.
We hear that loud and clear. We guess you do too, but is your work secure, do you know, or is there talk of cutbacks that would cut back even your lab's work, do you know?
I just can't. I can't project. They're budget cuts. We will see the budget cuts. We will do the best we can with what we have, and it's happened in the past, and we've been there for the public and for wildlife, and I think even if they cut us back, we just put in more time and put in weekend time, and we get the work done.
It's fascinating work. It's important work, and we're grateful to you for all the years you've spent doing it and for you right there with your scalpel and your wisdom and insight today. Carol Mattire at the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for your work and for being with us today, Carol.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, a snow leopard stronghold in Afghanistan. This is On Point. A recent discovery in Afghanistan by a team of researchers from the Wildlife Conservation Society is bringing some unusually bright news for the beautiful and highly endangered snow leopard. The elusive animal appears to have a vigorous, healthy population in the remote Wakhan region of far northeastern Afghanistan. With us now for the news is Joe Walston. He's director of the Asia Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society and joins us from his office at the Bronx Zoo in New York. Joe, thanks very much for being here.
Hello there, Tom.
So what's up there in this? This is the kind of almost panhandle or high tail that sticks out of Afghanistan between Pakistan and China. What have you discovered?
That's right. This is a fascinating corridor that extends through this gap between Tajikistan and Pakistan all the way to China, and it's an incredible set of high altitude valleys that is quite stunningly one of the most remote but beautiful places on this planet. And we've been working there for the last 5 years up in with the communities living in this area and studying and protecting wildlife and working with these communities. And what we've discovered is we knew there was going to be hopefully snow leopard up there. What we didn't expect and what we're delighted at is we've found over 16 locations where we've actually photographed snow leopards in their wild habitat, which is a real boost for conservation efforts.
Snow leopards are just incredible mammals. You can see photos and video at our website, onpointradio.org. But they've been highly endangered. What's put them in so much danger across their habitat in the Himalayas there? And how widespread is that habitat, Joe?
The snow leopard covers over a million hectares of upland and mountainous areas across the Himalayas, the Hindu Kush, the Pamirs, but it is at very low density, and as an apex predator, it's under a lot of threat, both from poaching for its incredible fur, which allows it to live up to many thousands of meters above sea level, mm-hmm. But also because it comes into conflict with local people and their livestock. So we are working with local communities and WCS in Afghanistan, working with the communities to help them with livestock and to prevent poaching of this quite incredible species.
They are, we use the word elusive. I mean, people can spend years looking for the snow leopard and, you know, maybe never see one. How did you come up with evidence that there's such a good population, a good pocket of them in this very high mountainous area of Afghanistan?
We've worked with these local communities, the Wakhi and the communities in the area, and also the Kyrgyz populations in the extreme east near the China border for a while now. And through their knowledge and through them actually requesting us to help them with this issue, we've been able to get out there. And we've combined basic boots on ground and effort with high-end technology. We've been putting out remote camera traps, which heat-in-motion camera traps, which detect when animals walk in front and take pictures. So we've got a fleet of these incredible pictures of these most amazing animals in their natural habitat in one of the most remote areas of the world.
You say camera trap. You don't mean that it actually traps physically the snow leopard, but what captures the image?
It traps in the right way. It traps a beautiful image of it takes a photograph when the sensors, when something that is warm moves in front of it. So that could be an individual, a person. But in this area, we've been setting them up in places we thought we'd get some wildlife, but we had no idea we would get so many, over 30 pictures in 16 locations at this site, which takes us, it takes a airplane and on horseback and by foot to be able to get into.
We're talking about maybe 4,500 snow leopards left in the world, maybe more, but real pressure on this species. What altitude is this at? How near human habitation are they, Joe?
So this area is a series of valleys that that are at least a 4,000 meter, 14,000 feet above sea level.
Mm-hmm.
They're the most incredible valleys, which again provide an image of Afghanistan, which is in stark contrast to those we traditionally get on here. And
is there war in these valleys, or is this beyond the fighting?
It's beyond the fighting. Now they're affected by the fighting. Everyone in Afghanistan in some way, directly or indirectly, is impacted by the conflict. But there is no direct conflict in these areas. These are the same communities that have lived there for hundreds and even thousands of years, and they're extremely poor. And as poor people traditionally around the world do, they're often highly dependent on their environment. They keep livestock. They require fuel, wood, and any problems of the environment directly and very quickly impacts them. So we're helping the local communities to be able to protect their livestock from predation, keep livestock grazing areas from being over harvested, and basically ensuring that they're also helping protect the wildlife for their own sake as well as for a number of other new economic activities, for instance, tourism.
And these 16 sightings, what kind of population does that suggest of snow leopards, this magnificent creature?
It basically indicates at a very basic level, it means that this site is providing significant evidence that this is a stronghold for the species. Now, although it's widespread over 12 countries in Asia, there are very, very few strongholds for this species. They're globally endangered, which means that they are threatened and close to extinction. And strongholds are hugely important for us to be able to have success stories and to rebuild this population. So the snow leopards in the Wakhan we have identified. We're now going into stage two, and stage two is going to be doing a more detailed survey, which is actually going to provide us with hopefully actual population numbers.
Well, the images are already quite incredible, and it's thrilling to hear of this good, strong population in such a remote valley of Afghanistan of snow leopards. Joe Walston with the Wildlife Conservation Society joining us from New York. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.